Well, good evening and welcome to this live stream on the 26th of September 2023. Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics here. Great to have you on board tonight for a very important conversation about property and what's going on. We're going to look at things like the downtrader activity, some of the banker mum and dad stuff, although you'll see it's broader than banker mum and dad, migration, and we'll look at how properties are moving around in different areas, because of course regional property versus property closer to Sydney, for example, is behaving quite different at the moment. So we'll get into some of those. Just before I bring Chris in, let me just remind you, as always do, that we're not providing specific financial or legal or property advice. It's a general conversation. The chat is moderated, but feel free to throw your comments in, and you know, I always watch what's going on as best I can. But if you want to get my attention, use @walktheworld, because that'll mean that it comes into my queue, and then there's a good chance that I will see it and be able to handle it. I've also enabled Super Chat, which means that you can get your question to the top of the list if you'd like to get there, or indeed make a contribution to what we do here. Always greatly appreciated. It helps to run the costs of what we do. Anyway, let's bring Chris in. Hello, Chris. How are you doing?
Martin, life's good, mate. How are you doing over there in sunny UK?
I'm doing all right, actually. I'm pleased to say that I've now got the technology sorted out. You know, everything's sort of sorted out. I've got the redecoration done, the boiler installed. Everything is looking good. And I'm now getting back to making more regular shows and those sorts of things. So, yeah, it's all good. How are you doing?
Mate, life's good. Watch out the BBC for you, right? He's going to take it over. Life's good, mate. Double dad here. So 3 and a 1-year-old. Son's nearly 2 now. So, yeah, getting out of the trenches. And, yeah, we've been a big year. We've grown our team dramatically. We're at 17, 18 people now. So, yeah, lots going on. And, as you know, always things changing. So, yeah, it's always good to catch up.
Yeah, great. And we should talk about Blusk. Or Blue Sky, that's the new brand, right?
Yeah, we've been doing a lot of partnerships with financial advisors, because I was an old financial advisor, and we decided to rebrand out of Wealthful to Blusk. And, you know, Blusk is sort of a play on Blue Sky, which is, you know, Blue Sky thinking. Clients come to us, you know, they're a bit confused, a little bit unsure what's the right move, you know, considering multiple different options. So it's quite cloudy, and that's how clients sometimes feel. And what our role is really to guide them and give them that blue sky, that real clarity on what's the next best move and how this decision links into the next property decision. And yeah, we've been partnering with a lot with different financial advisors. So the Wealth in the name wasn't great. So yeah, that's the new name.
Excellent. And I was putting it in last night into the into the system. Now I understand Blue Sky. Yeah, got it. it's very good. Now look, there's a lot to talk about, Chris. I want to start with something that I've noticed in my surveys relating to the banker mum and dad. Right now, we've known for a long, long time that some people can get into property courtesy of their parents. And, you know, I've been tracking the growth of the banker mum and dad, and it drops and rose a little bit. But in the last 18 months, I've noticed something really interesting. More people are reaching for a greater pool of relatives, you know, grandparents, et cetera, to try and grab some cash to be able to get into the market. And as a result of that, quite a few of the transactions that I'm seeing in my surveys are actually now with quite big deposits from not just the bank of mum and dad, but it's from the family bank. Now, are you seeing any of that in your neck of the world?
Martin, obviously we've been doing this for 5 years, I think, all the way back to 2018, maybe even 2017, right? And I was thinking about coming on here tonight. I was like, what's my big thing that's surprising me right now? And this is it. And so when we started chatting pre this show tonight, absolutely, that's the thing that we're seeing. You know, no one would have thought that, and myself included, the borrowing capacity is falling 40%, rates going up 4% in under, you know, basically 12 months, would lead to the property market falling 10% and then start coming back. You know, it just, that's such a big hit to borrowing capacity. So how can prices stay up? And the reason for that is really intergenerational wealth and higher incomes, pent up demand that are still buying on lower price points. So potentially they, you know, would have bought at 2 mil, maybe now they're buying at 1.3 mil. You know, someone would have bought at 1.4, maybe it's buying at a mil. So it's a sort of cascade down of higher income borrowers that are still able to buy because they've still got significant income to still enter. And because it's only about four and a half times income, maybe up to five times income, but we were seeing 7.5, 8, you know, all the way back in 2014, we're seeing 10, 12 times income. So ridiculously tight lending. And, you know, what clients are coming to us is they're basically figuring out what they can borrow. And not everyone's in this fortunate position. So this inequality situation is going to get a lot worse, unfortunately. And so what you're going to see is, like you say, I don't think it's the parents. I actually think it is coming from grandparents. I think they've done really well in recent booms, particularly the last couple of years, you know, that 21, 2020, you know, that extra 30, 40% increase to the, you know, their asset. They're getting to later in life, whether they're going to aged care or dying, whether they're downsizing, somehow that, or even just passing the money on, you know, the changes with super, that's got to be in their back of their mind as well. Like, well, it's going to get taxed. Should we just pass it on? So I think that's what's happening. We're seeing biggest deposits I've ever seen. And sometimes clients will come to us and they go, well, I know what my gap is. I'm just going to go and ask family. Now, obviously there's a fortunate few that can do that. But if they can't do that, it's the higher income people that are probably dominating in the market because they're able to still have the borrowing capacity. So yeah, it defies belief, Martin, when you think about it, right? My worry though is that the overconfidence that's building in the market, right? There's already an overconfidence. Then this is like, well, if the property market can survive a 4% drop in borrowing capacity and still goes up in value, it's invincible. And that sort of mentality hopefully doesn't perpetuate. But I do feel like it's starting to get there. It's sort of like there's nothing that could knock this thing over. And what we're also seeing, though, is that, you know, buyers have been surprised like they were in 2016, like they were in 2019, like they were in 2020, 2021. And they're potentially been trying to be a bit opportunistic. So we've got buyers who've been looking for 1, 2+ years. And now they're starting to feel some pain because prices are starting to run on them. And they're already making compromises to enter the market. And they're not sure if they're willing to make even further compromises. And they're getting a bit edgy. And so we're starting to see not many transactions were happening over the one to 1.5 range. There's a lot of turnover in the sub-million range, which is not typically our market. But a lot of that sort of 1.52 buyers were very, like, I'm not sure if I really want to transact. There's no urgency there. I just want to see how things play out. But now they're wishing they transacted early. They can see that delaying the decision has actually meant that prices are running on them. And it's an interesting time. Like, it's October now, and I've talked about 15 minutes here, Martin, but it's October now. We're coming into November. There's probably 4, 5, 6 weeks of new listings at best. No one really wants to list in sort of November, December time. And buyers are a little bit nervous. They're like, should I buy an investment property? Should I just – and they don't really want the market to run on them because they've been burnt so many times before. So, yeah, it's crazy market dynamics, right?
It is crazy. And, you know, I think three observations from me, Chris. Firstly, if you are in the fortunate position where you have a family that's got significant wealth and, you know, superannuation has done quite well over the medium term, as well as property values. And, of course, equities have gone up quite well over that period too. So quite a few people in my surveys do have that pool of wealth, which is quite big. They've now got this 3 million cap on the superannuation coming in, which is definitely changing the landscape. And there's also this down trading trend driven, I think, by the 300k or 600k for two that you can put into superannuation. So what I'm seeing quite often is it's part of an overall management of that older intergenerational money. And part of it is then flowing it back down to help people buy into the property market at the bottom end. So if you are in the fortune position of being able to do that, then you're able to transact. And so quite what I'm seeing in my surveys is people are coming in with quite low loan to value ratios, which means that they can actually get good rates and they've got enough buffer. So if things go a bit wobbly, they feel comfortable. But there's another whole group of people that are completely scared about what's going on at the moment. They see property prices in some areas still rising. They see their own affordability dropping by up to 40% from where they were a year, 18 months ago. And it's a real scary thing for them. Quite a few of them are in the rental sector. And, you know, it feels as though this dream of owning a property is getting further and further and further away. My concern is with those, that some of them are then saying, well, I've got to do anything to buy anything. And so I'm seeing some bad mistakes being made. For example, people buying small investment properties in, you know, out of suburban areas on relatively low prices, but with low rents and with lots of issues attached to them. So the problem is that you can actually get scared into doing the wrong thing or scared into doing nothing. So that's what I'm seeing at the moment. It's a really, really complicated market as a result of that.
Yeah, I mean, the first point around the intergenerational wealth, I mean, the intergenerational report was out, you know, recently, but, you know, if you just look at the numbers, like $10 trillion in residential property, $2 trillion in debt, $8 trillion of equity, just rough numbers, right? And that is sitting with the, you know, 60, 70, 80-year-olds. And, you know, property's done well for them, right? That's our number one asset class. It's dwarf super, it dwarfs shares, et cetera. So, and, you know, I think a lot of them are like, well, actually, I want to help my kids get in because we know when rates are high, it's more opportunistic. We know if rate cuts happen, it's going to be great for prices. And so they're almost like trying to help their kids. And that's another incentive to help them. But I absolutely agree. That second pool, the rental crisis is also, whether that's just driven by migration, whether it's driven by house formation, whether it's built by investors exiting the market, which is absolutely happening, lots of different reasons. But the rental crisis and low vacancy rates is scaring people out of like renting, right? Like, so there's no, everyone's, lots of people being kicked out of their homes because of the investors selling or they want to move back in. And so they're like, so, well, renting's not a viable option because A, my rents have gone up 20-30%, but B, that confidence and security of tenure isn't there. And so even though it's going to cost me more to get a mortgage under higher interest rates, that's better than being homeless and not being able to rent. And we're definitely seeing that there's that pressure. So that rental crisis is actually leading to support house prices or property prices. And then the rental crisis in itself is people who can't afford to buy and even rent. So then, you know, that's a mindful. We've got friends at the moment who, you know, like literally the investors sold their place and two young girls and, you know, unlikely to get another rental just because of how much competition in their situation. It's super stressful. And then, you know, and they're in a fortunate position where they've still got a roof over their head, let alone, you know, the people who don't. So that rental crisis is a real worry. And I just think this inequality, I think the building crisis is another thing, right? So, you know, developers can't make profit. Like, yep, they just cannot sell them at current prices and make profit, especially in New South Wales. The cost of labor, cost of materials, cost of profit, cost of land. Like, and, you know, if I was a developer, would I just be trying to, if I can't sell it? And that, so that also targets that upper end, right? So I can make money on the downsizers and the bigger family competing with family homes, but I can't make it sense trying to sell it to investors or trying to sell it to first home buyers. They're just, budgets aren't there. And a lot of investors have been burnt with going to high density because, you know, that's, if you look at the pain and gain report, there's so many, everyone sort of kind of gets that now that, you know, high density is not the greatest investment. So, yeah, I think there's all these elements. And then you've got, you know, 2,000 people a day moving here, right? Like, what's the migration going to be? 500,000-700,000 this year. So on top of everything else, putting additional pressure. So, yeah, that would be my take. There's so much going on. But yes, there's a big negative. Rates are up, borrowing capacity is down. And what we're seeing with listings, like there is this, you know, out of season or winter listings and things like that, but they haven't been great listings. And I think it was just people trying to get in before spring. So because there was very low listings, it made sense to try to front run it. And rather than try to list your property in September, October, when everyone else is listing, a lot of agents were desperate for listings and then telling their vendors, you know what, and they were working winter because times were tough. Why don't you list now when there's nothing on the market? And so we saw this increase in listings a bit out of seasonal and everyone was like, well, that means everyone's forced selling. Well, no, I just think it was a front running of spring sales. And there's not that much quality really on the market coming on. I think everyone's stuck in their homes. Like even if we've got clients who are in apartments or they're in smaller houses, they would absolutely like to upgrade. They need to from a demographic point of view. They're on great income. So in the past, they would have been able to upgrade. But to do that now is just not feasible. The equity they've got plus what they can borrow isn't enough to get them into a quality asset. So they're stuck. And they don't want to sell because they'd be out of the market and rent. So they're almost like a prisoner in their home. Like, and yes, it's they've still got a roof over, so it's not the end of the world, but they would like to upgrade, but they just can't. So then that property just is stuck on the market where it would be transacting. And so I think people are going to live in their homes for even longer, right? That's already doubled over the last 20 years. I think people have gone from living in their homes for 7 years to 14 years. What happens if we just get our home and then we get stuck because we can't keep jumping? And I think that's what's really playing out right now.
No, I think that's the point. The point you make about the upgrade is fascinating. I'm because that's one of the categories that I look at in my surveys. And a lot of people have pretty much given up the idea of trying to upgrade and move to somewhere bigger, despite the fact they want to because they've got a growing family, et cetera, et cetera. Simply because, one, they can't find properties that would actually fit in an area they want. And two, the economics don't work anymore. So you've got that blocking situation going on at the moment. And you've also got this other point about a lot of people in the rental sector really, really trying desperately to find anything to get out of the rental sector because they're just being hauled over the coals, you know, with rents going through the roof and continuing to rise. And there's no expectation that that is going to stop. But the stock of attractive or reasonable properties at that lower end is a real problem because a lot of the stock that is coming on at the moment, there is some, but it's not dramatically large. But a lot of it's old investment properties that actually have been under-maintained and need a lot of work and are not necessarily in really attractive positions. So there's a real mismatch between what's being listed and what people would aspire to buy at that lower end. So that's a mess. But interestingly, what I do see is that some of those more expensive investment properties are actually being snapped up by older people who already have two or three investment properties. So there's I mean, these cross currents, it is as complex, I think, as I've ever seen. And then I just finish. The regional overlay is fascinating, right? Because we're not seeing that same dynamic in regional areas. So prices in many regional areas are still falling. Listings are actually rising in some areas. So the story in and around Sydney and the other major urban centres is quite different from some of the regional areas as well. So it's a real mess.
Yeah. Yeah, so absolutely. But your point around not everything is selling, right? So absolutely, there's still properties that are super compromised, whether it's the street or the aspect or privacy or noise or whatever it might be, the part of the suburb, etc. So there's definitely properties that are still not turning over very fast. But then there's properties selling in a day. We've got multiple clients buying the last month in under 24 hours because they're so on it. They just want to make the transaction happen, but they're just patient because high rates means you're going to be patient. Like it's when rates are 2%, the market's in, you know, taking off, then people, you know, that just leads to poor behavior, right? Because there's the cost of owning is really low, that people just go, it's all right, it's better than renting, I might as well just upgrade it. And so I think that 2% was forcing all properties within a suburb to grow, and particularly at the bottom end, just because it had much FOMO was in the market. But we do see pickiness still in the market. So that sort of aligns what you're thinking. The regions, the hybrid sort of work from home, work back to the office, that tug of war is still well underway. I would say that the employers, if anything, starting to win again. We're seeing clients that expected to be able to work from home a lot more than they are. We're seeing everyone hugging back towards the capital city. We're seeing very few clients wanting to make those big lifestyle shifts, you know, leaving Sydney to move to Brisbane, to Byron. We've still got them, but it's nowhere near the level that it was. And usually they're business owners, or usually they've got, you know, some level in their career or something like that where they're almost like dialing down, but it's, you know, that sort of younger person climbing a ladder, let's say, they're very much conscious if they leave, are they going to be able to get another job? And particularly, you know, there's that concern around that hype around, you know, talent war, you know, unemployment going lower. I don't think that's there anymore. I think employers are a little bit conscious of what's happening and, you know, can see their businesses are slowing down and they're not as gung-ho about asking for wage increases. So we're seeing wage price, you know, wages increase is definitely slowing down. We're not seeing that big bumps like we were, and that confidence around future earnings isn't there. People are a little bit more concerned. So and with that, they're wanting to stay close to the city. So, you know, they're looking for that bigger two-bed apartment rather than, say, moving to the Central Coast or Wollongong and getting a house. But I do think that'll come back. I do think the hybrid work will be here. You know, I do think as that gets more and more embedded, people can't afford that what they want in the city because that's what's run, because that's where the competition pushes prices up. And then they'll say, well, we'll have to, this is our option. And we'd love to stay close to the city. It's just not possible. Right, let's make this lifestyle shift into those, particularly the commutable locations, the 1 hour from the city. And then the 2 hour from the city, I think that's a, you know, it is reliant on very flexible work, right? You know, one day the week in the city, maybe one day a fortnight or, you know, and someone potentially leaving their families to stay for a couple of nights. It's a harder sell.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I sold in Thurrul, as you may know, back in March, and prices have continued to fall in that area, which is interesting. Closer in, of course, to the city, there's a whole new story. And I guess one of the other themes we should explore is the migration part of the story. So my question, Chris, are you seeing much in the way of migration coming in with, you know, money to buy immediately? Because I would assume that Sydney would be one of those areas where migrants would want to buy. Or are they tending to be more into the rental sector initially and then sort of taking their time? I certainly know that some people in my surveys have come into the country relatively quickly and within 6 months did buy. But I'm not quite sure statistically whether that's a thing or not, or whether it's just the old one.
Look, I wouldn't say we've seen too much of that, but that might not be who we see come to our business. So right. We do see a bit of expats coming back. And that was typically one of our buyers over sort of 2 mil. I'm sort of going back through them, thinking about some. Some were, you know, basically living over in Hong Kong, Singapore, Dubai, London, and were trying to get a base back in Australia. Some were still living overseas. Some had actually moved back. We've got some ones moving over from New Zealand right now, you know, entering at the top end. So absolutely, I do think there's, you know, people who are Aussies overseas that are moving back and wanting to secure. They saw that was a bit of an opportunity over the last year or so. And whether that's continuing, I don't know. We'd probably say it's just the same pace, but the local buyers sort of, and I don't think the migration, I do think it hits the rental market first. Like, so we're back in COVID times and we rewatched one of our conversations back in 2020, there was like, okay, migration's dead. The Australian property Ponzi scheme's over. Prices are going to fall, right? And I was just like, well, that's not the reality. They're just not going to move here straight away. We just don't. And what ended up happening, right? It was a internal, you know, migration was probably a bigger story, right? And that caught the driver of housing demand, whether it's to the regions or whether it's interstate, that's what was driving. So it was actually not maybe people moving from overseas, but people moving around the country and creating transactions because their lifestyle needs were changing. So, I don't think the migration thing typically leads straight. And obviously a lot of students. But, you know, if you've got a bit of money in Asia, let's say, and you're sending a child to Australia and you can buy, and they're because they've got rental issues, maybe it's an option of just buying, you know, getting that money safer in Australian residential properties than it is in where it is in your country. And maybe just buying an apartment for my child to rent through uni or just to live in is better than the hassles of them trying to secure a rental property in this market. So maybe that's happening as well. But we don't see too much.
Okay, interesting. No, I mean, it does vary, I think, but it is definitely one of the factors that I'm seeing. Now, Cookie Boy asked a question a little earlier on about rate cuts. Do we see rate cuts in the short to medium term? You know, some people are talking about higher Fed rates, et cetera, et cetera. Bonds are taking off. Is it a good time to fix? So what's your perspective on rates and trajectory? How do you actually advise people at the moment with this rather complex interest rate environment that we're in? Because, you know, originally the thought was, well, rates will drop quite quickly, but maybe they won't, and that might change the formulation.
Look, I look at a lot of the fixed rates versus variable rates. The bet is that rate cuts aren't happening, right? So, you know, if you want to fix right now, you're either thinking rates cuts aren't going to happen anytime soon. If anything, rates are going to go back up, right? And because you're already paying a premium over the variable rate. And so it's a big call because you could lock yourself in on a higher rate. If rate cuts do happen under any significant level, you'd be regretting it, similar to, you know, other big times in the past when big rate cuts have happened. I mean, like, everyone's got it wrong over the last, you know, probably all the way back to 2008, right? UK zero. No one would have thought that was zero in, you know, 2022, 2023, right? So obviously they've got up to 5% now. So I think it's hard to obviously to predict that, right? But I mean, I think the consumer, right, is believing what the media is saying, right? And that's what matters. It doesn't matter what I think, Martin, or you think. It's what does the mass market believe? What are they, what do buyers believe at open homes and auctions? Like, that's what matters. What our opinion doesn't really matter. It's what the market believes. And I would say that the market, that when clients come to us, they, in particularly the start of the year when there was a, you know, the pause in rates, they were getting pretty confident, right? But that May and June was a little bit of a lesson to them. And they're like, actually, this could is not over. But that was a, we definitely saw buyers cool it because, you know, there was a bit of expectations that rate could maybe go, the RBA could get closer to 5%. And that was feeding in. There's a lot of media around it. But then with the last three pauses and the commentary that maybe it's going to continue and then rate cuts starting to come into the conversation, you know, the banks, KPMG today's front page of the, you know, AFR, prices are going to run in the next couple of years. So the consumer is almost starting to believe, hey, rates are not going to go up anymore. Whether they do or not, it doesn't matter. The consumer is starting to believe that, right? And the real estate agents are starting to believe that. They don't know what they're doing, but that doesn't matter. They're telling consumers this, right?
Yeah.
This is what the market is. It's not people like you and I, Martin, that, you know, think this logically, right? So, and if they start believing the rate cuts are coming, they will act as if rate cuts are here. They will take that because they'll be like, well, I want to get in before. I know rates come, my mortgage is going to get cheaper. And, you know, while borrowing capacities won't go up till rate cuts happen, the desire to use all their borrowing capacity and to stretch and potentially borrow more from family will be there. And then when rate cuts potentially do happen, would that also come with APRA stepping in? Would that also be post-tax cuts? And would that be through bank innovation? Like, are we going to see 40-year home loans? They're already seeing 35s. You know, another bank came out last week with a 40. Are we going to see reductions to, I don't know, increases to rental income? Rents have gone up. Like, there's bank policy innovations bound to happen, right? Banks are driven by credit growth. Banks drive our economy, right? So are we going to see those three things? Rate cuts, APRA, tax cuts, bank innovation, and borrowing capacity is going to jump from four and a half times back to over six times. That would be in a lot of people's interest, right? And so, and you could argue it's also first home buyers' interests and the rental market, because that's going to give more borrowing capacity to investors to supply more rental housing. So I would say that that's the worry, right? If that starts to happen, and listings stay low. Listings aren't going to go through the roof. Like, you're not going to see arrears rates go through the roof. You're not going to see all this forced selling. I just don't believe it, right? We've got one loan in arrears out of over 1,000. You know, people are doing what they can to stay in their homes. It's just maybe the non-banks where they're getting some arrears going up, but they were people who stretched to the nth degree. That's why they went to a non-bank. They were highly leveraged investors, not the... and a lot of people who took on bigger loans in 21, they did that with the mindset that they're going to be earning higher incomes in the future. You didn't sign up to a big loan unless you were confident about your future financially. So listing numbers will stay low. They're already at all-time lows. And quality listings will stay low because people are stuck in their homes. And so if you see this play out of low listings over the next 12 months, particularly in things that suit, you know, the family market, then the sentiment shifts, the borrowing capacity shifts. You just got to wonder, like, would the market run really fast? And, you know, obviously, you know, that's not what a lot of people on here like to hear about, but that's, I can envisage another 2019 scenario when those ingredients happen, because they'll be very quickly factored into prices. In particular for any buyer in the market now, they would quickly spend that borrowing capacity because they would know they need to. You know, a client today, like, you know, low 1 millions, they absolutely need another 100 or 200,000. So if I could say you could borrow another 100 or 200,000, they would spend it tomorrow. And that's all the way up the chain. People would have to spend it because the market would be moving, and they'd be able to.
Right. And just on the underwriting questions, you know, if you think about the process of underwriting, there are two factors. One is the income multiple, and that definitely has come back, hasn't it, from where we were, two or three years ago. The other is the affordability buffers that people are actually needing to use. And certainly APRA, well, opened the throttle, then turned it back slightly. So there is potentially some leverage to change that. But it is more complicated when interest rates are so high, because a lot of people are actually still extending themselves. In my surveys, I'm seeing a lot of people who are now paying, you know, 35 or 40% of their income on the mortgage, which is, that's a big deal. And it's gone up quite dramatically from where it was and is continuing to rise. CBA's figures would suggest it will continue to rise. And of course, we've still got the fixed rates rolling off. So I wonder what capacity there is for the regulators to sort of open the spigots a bit more, particularly if property prices are continuing to run away and you know, inflation staying high and income isn't growing, because you're right, income was spiking, but it slid a little bit. So again, some of those unknown unknowns seem to me to be quite important to think about. But you're right, it is about what the herd thinks, because if the herd all goes in the same direction, it's sufficiently powerful to be able to push markets higher again, which of course explains quite a lot of the stuff you see on social media and on the various real estate portals.
Yeah, I mean, Shane Elliott, ANZ, last week came out and said it's impossible for first home buyers to buy it.
Yeah.
And it is, yep. You know, and so if there's a pressure to say that we need to increase borrowing capacities to allow more people to buy, then I think the big picture is that APRA will step in. I mean, they've already allowed banks to do 1% assessment rates on refinances.
Mm.
How about they change that to 1% assessment rates for first home buyers? Like, I don't know. I think, you know, first-time buyers are also, with their incomes are going up rather than they're at the peak of their earning cycle. So, you know, banks are creative. We all saw payment holidays back in COVID times. No one thought that was possible. And so, you know, you've got to aware that there is a cartel there that drives these things, not just the construction industry, the banks, the profits, it goes on and on and on, right? Stamp duty. Like you know, they need transactions. The state government needs it. Right? Look how much debt they're in, right? So they need people to be selling from. So they don't want people in mortgage prisoners and property prisoners, and they can't upgrade. That means they get stamp duty once every 20 years, not once every 10 years. So they need people to transact. So if you tighten up lending, then you're going to basically freeze up the market, and that's exactly what's happening. So, I think there'll be tweaks to policy. They'll be relaxed to what banks can do. And yeah, you know, I think that's the first sign is around what they're doing for mortgage prisoners around the 1% buffers, and who's to say it doesn't keep going.
Yeah, and I'll tell you one thing that I noticed in my surveys again, some people were able to actually pull equity out of their property sufficient to be able to cover their repayments over the next year to 18 months, and the banks were quite happy to do that. So the equity withdrawal part of the process is definitely still there, and with prices in some areas going sideways or still slightly higher, that equity milking, as it were, is another lever that they can pull.
Absolutely. So like, for example, let's say you're a client and your mortgage repayments, I don't know, just do round numbers, let's say 10 grand a month, but you can only afford 6 right now because things are tough, but you can still get access to equity. Do you, and your buffer's going low, so you get access to 100 or 200 grand. Do you sell your house, or do you get access to your equity and live off and go into 100 grand more debt? Because that's 100 grand more debt, let's say, over the next couple of years, 4 grand a month, 2 years, versus selling a property, and this would be a 10 grand a month, would be a couple of million dollar property, right? The stamp duty on that would be 100 grand and selling costs. So, you know, do you really want to go and burn all these transaction costs and then try to get back into the market when you can afford it more, whether it's interest rates or jobs or, you know, your partner goes back to work? And so absolutely, people are living off equity and buffers. I do think buffers are getting pretty tight, but I do think people are, you know, doing whatever they can, selling shares, they're leaning on family, they're doing second jobs, they're swapping jobs, they're doing whatever they can to cover those mortgages. And they've got the confidence that, you know, there is an end in sight. Now, whether that's true or not doesn't matter. The consumer starts to believe now that, you know, maybe that rates aren't going to go to 5% at the RBA. You know, I'm not having to worry about, you know, 7% interest rates. And that's another good point. I mean, at the moment, I'm saying my own point's a good point, but the, you know, a bank rate at 5.75, right? I mean, the mortgage wars has definitely come back a bit. You know, like back in May, June, discounts were just unbelievable. Like, it was just crazy, the loans they were doing. I mean, it was all the banks were whinging about it in the AFR. Like,
yep. This
is all under the cost of capital, but then they're all playing the game. And so they have come back, but competition's competition. They're still ridiculously. So we're getting rates, you know, low 5.7s to high 5.7s on an RBA rate of 4.1. So about a 1.6 margin on top. which is unheard of. I thought 2% was good a couple of years. Now we're getting 1.6. So a lot of those rate increases aren't factoring through. And bank retention pricing is ridiculously strong. Even if the bank believes that you can't refinance, often banks will just still price you like a new customer if you ask for a better deal. So anyone listening who hasn't called, they're crazy. You know, just call your bank and ask for a better deal. And if you can't, then you most likely just refi, because competition's fierce.
Absolutely. And talking about refinance, Cookie Boy asked earlier on, are you seeing any stressed refinancing? Now, of course, you've got a particular segment of the market that you service, so you might not necessarily be seeing the, you know, the Great Unwash in Western Sydney, but are you seeing any stressed refinancing?
Absolutely. So, you know, there's a lot of people who maybe they haven't got those pay increases and maybe they've over-leveraged, maybe they've bought a chunky investment property, or maybe they have got multiple investment properties. We did, especially particularly maybe 6 months ago, I might have mentioned on our last chat, Martin, but we were seeing a lot of investors selling, particularly ones with bigger portfolios, and, you know, selling one that's going to give them a big bump in cash. And that would allow them potentially to refinance under the 1% rules and would just get them, reset their repayments, reset their interest only, but would give them a cash buffer and allow them to get through. So yeah, there's absolutely, I mean, our clients doing it at a time when they can't, going on payment holidays? Well, no, we've only got one client on that out of all our clients. And so we're not seeing that level, but absolutely clients are very conscious of their repayments. They're very concerned how much they've gone up, but they're doing what they need to maintain those. They're not like just rushing and selling their properties. You know, I can't really think of many at all that have just sold because they're worried that, you know, if they, the prices are going to keep falling and that, you know, it's best just to get out. Like, and besides investors, I've definitely seen some investors sell multiple properties.
Well, let me just unpack that, because I think the investors is a really interesting area. And again, about 60% of property investors now, from a cash flow perspective in my surveys, are underwater. So it comes down to whether they are actually covering sufficient to be able to actually make it work. I suppose you've got the tax offsets, but also the expectation of future capital growth. Now, if you're right, and that property prices are going to continue to sort of, you know, move higher ahead because of the factors that we've been talking about, then property investors might well say, okay, well, I'm prepared to wear the cash flow pressure because of the capital appreciation. But I'm interested that a lot of property investors do seem to be jettisoning properties, particularly those that are performing less well. And I'm not quite sure what's really driving it. Have you got any insights as to, you know, why those property investors are choosing now to sell? Is it part of a, you know, a down trading philosophy, or is it just affordability?
Look, I think there's part then. I haven't seen the returns they want there. You know, they haven't performed really well in the boom. When rates were 2%, they didn't go up. But they also don't have to sell them at fire sale prices. They've got a bit of equity there. That bit of equity means a lot. It's better than losing money. Just get 50K in the hand versus losing another 5 or 10 grand a year. A lot of investors have the belief is, I don't want it to cost me any money. I just want it to wash itself. I don't care if it goes up in value. It just doesn't want it to cost me any money. That sort of belief's perpetuated in the investment circles. And so there is a lot of investors who went and bought positive cash flow property that's no longer positive. And potentially it hasn't gone up in value. And so I do think there's a bit of that. You can see Pippa did some research. I can't recall the exact numbers, but, you know, let's say there's 3 million investment properties, you know, a good 200,000-300,000 are looking to sell, right? And that's in a rental crisis. And if those they do sell, like, are they going to be going to other investors? Maybe. You know, I'm surprised that there's a bit of – there is some investor pressure there. Like, there are new investors coming to market. Whether they've – in that home, they can't upgrade. So they're going, well, I'll use my capacity on investment property. Or they're a first home buyer that feels like they can't buy, but they want to buy an investment property. Or they maybe have one investment property and they're like, you know what, now's a good time to add another. They're super happy in their home. They have no plans to upgrade ever. And so there is a bit of, but I don't think it's offsetting the amount of investors leaving. And that's what's causing a rental crisis. If you've got, you know, 200,000 investors selling, and a lot of them are selling to owner occupiers, first home buyers, then you're getting a huge reduction in rental supply, and then you're not getting enough investors to offset that. And I think that's what's playing out. And, you know, you've got all the things with, you know, I think Dan Andrews resigned today, didn't he? But, you know, there's lots of things happening with down there. There's lots of things happening against investors. For many years, they've been targeted with easy policy. And so, you know, the Airbnb thing was a similar thing, land taxes, tenancy rights, et cetera. So, you know, higher interest rates on mortgages, issues around interest-only loans. So investors have been the one that have been sort of the problem, I guess. And, you know, a lot of investors haven't entered when they needed to, hence why we've got a big rental crisis.
Yeah, I think the Airbnb thing's quite important to talk about because, of course, there are now moves to lift the taxes in some states on Airbnb properties. And certainly, if I look at the mix of property in my surveys, I do see Airbnb as quite a significant factor in some areas. But to my mind, it's not necessarily the biggest issue. What I think we should also be talking about is the fact there is still a lot of vacant property. In other words, property was deliberately purchased some time ago and is deliberately being held vacant, particularly in some of the high-rise areas of Sydney and Melbourne. And a lot of that's in international investors who are holding it on the expectation of capital appreciation. So for me, this vacant property discussion is probably one that needs to be unpacked a bit more than has generally been in the mainstream media, because to my mind, there would potentially be a way of increasing supply. I mean, let's face it, just building more stuff is going to take too long. And the history has not been very good, although the you know, the initiatives are being pulled now perhaps a bit stronger. So we've got this real supply question. And to my mind, the vacant property question needs to be more unpacked than it is generally, because I think Airbnb is part of it, but I don't think it's the main part of it.
Yeah, great. You know, it's an easy one and people make sense, right, if we get those Airbnbs back into the long-term rental market. But, you know, they are in certain pockets. It's not the spread. You know, you go on Airbnb, they're not like they're spread across evenly. They're in the city, they're in, you know, inner ring locations. And usually that's not really where the biggest problems are in the property market. The vacant tax thing, I mean, Census will say there's 1 million properties free on Census night, right? But, you know, some electricity data, I'm pretty sure, came out a few months ago, and it said like 1.7% yes. of properties didn't have any electricity usage, right? So that's nowhere near, you know, 1.7 on 11 million dwellings is sort of like 190,000. Still big problem. And so we should have a vacancy tax, I believe, right? If you haven't got something to justify you doing something with that land. I also think the second home, you know, you could see that with Dan Andrews in Victoria with the land tax. That's what it's targeting there. You know, you've got your house, your holiday house, and you've got your home. You don't put it on Airbnb. That could be a property for the rental market. So why don't we tax people with second homes a little bit more? And I think that's coming on the table more and more. I think the Scott Keck idea was a really good idea. I mean, Scott's been around a long time in the property market. So Charter Keck Cramer, if people want to check his business out, they do a lot of consultancy to the development market. And I mean, he's basically came up with the idea, which, you know, you should be able to rent out rooms. You should be able to rent out your granny flats and not have to pay A, tax on it, but also B, not affecting your capital gains tax exemptions, which does stop a lot of people. You know, why would you rent out a room in your home, pay tax on it, have all issues with your income tax return, and then potentially affect your capital gains tax exemption? It's all too complicated. So why don't they do a 3-year moratorium on allowing people to rent out rooms, and just to help us get through this rental crisis? I think that's a really good move. But yeah, a lot of the things that the government needs to put their hand in their pocket and yeah, but you know, do they really care about these problems? I don't know. It's more about the next election cycle, right?
It's all about announceables, as I keep saying, right? So they can announce their housing strategy and they can announce their jobs strategy. But when you actually peel it back and actually ask, well, actually, what's it really going to do? Is it really going to make a huge amount of difference? Probably the answer is not a lot, but it is actually to do with the election cycle rather than actually the strategic cycle, which is a problem not just, by the way, in Australia, but it's true in the UK and other places too. But it does make it very complicated.
Exactly. The 1.2 million homes, you know, even Dan Andrews at the developer with Assembly last week. I mean, Assembly are doing a lot of money with super funds, but they can't build hundreds of thousands of apartments. Yeah, they can add some key worker housing and some affordability housing, and it's totally good and we should do all that stuff and the government should invest, but that's just a band-aid on a big problem, right? They aren't going to solve structural issues. So I think we need wins right now. And like you say, vacancy tax, Airbnb, second homes, all these sort of things should be on the table to alleviate a rental crisis. We shouldn't have people not living, nowhere to live.
Absolutely. Well, let me just throw a couple of specific case studies, because you know, I talk to quite a few people through my one-to-one conversations, and this is a sort of a stylized example, but it's actually a real based on real experience. So I was talking to somebody the other day who's in rental accommodation at the moment and is unable to afford to buy an owner-occupied property in the area that they want to be in. The reason they're there is because of the local schools, et cetera, et cetera. But they're also concerned about their exposure to the rental market, but also think they're not actually exposed to the property market and they want to. So they've actually sort of started to look at investment properties, cheaper investment properties, further out, a long way from anywhere, because they were cheap. And when you actually do the math, you know, the cash flows don't look particularly flash, and the capital appreciation doesn't look great. But the sense was, I have to get back into property. I need to get into property. So I guess the question is, does it make sense to jump at any investment property anywhere just to get back into the property market, or is it more complicated?
Look, it's definitely an issue right now. I literally had this call, probably the last call today, I think it was. A similar situation, buying in Melbourne. You know, they've grown up in this part of Melbourne. They've got family in that part of Melbourne. They've got one on the way. They've got a little one. They really want to stay in that pocket. They potentially could make it happen. It's very, very tight. Like, they haven't got intergenerational wealth and all this sort of stuff, right? And so they've missed out a couple of times. And, you know, I think the motivation today was this news of a second one coming. And, you know, the stress is, you know, they started looking at other suburbs, and they got kicked out of their rental, so they had to go and move into another rental, and they moved to an area that was maybe a bit more affordable, but the lifestyle impact wasn't great, and so they don't really ideally want to make that lifestyle shift. Maybe they will. So they were like, well, maybe we should just move back and rent where we really want to be and then buy an investment property. And the issue with that comes not just now. Yeah, they've got better having the money in a property, let's say, not really, than having it in the bank. But what ends up happening is, even if that works out, they've got to pay stamp duty, they've got to pay selling costs, they've got to pay capital gains tax. Whatever they make there, if ultimately they're then going to use those profits to try to enter into the good parts of a housing market, it's going to be extremely hard to outrun it after all those costs, because you've got to make a lot more than that growth, and then you've got to time it really well. And when you've got kids and you've got school zones and things like that. So my concern in that situation is, what are they doing with their longer term solution around living? Yeah. And are they, you know, yes, they've got money better off in the bank in their mind than in a property, but how is that all going to come together? Like, how's the sequence of this going to play out? And so sometimes people are they can potentially do that if they've got a real strong growth in their income in the next years, or they're getting a lot of money inheritance, or so that potentially they can go, well, yeah, I can't buy what I want today, but I could do that in a few years' time. And maybe I could go and buy an investment now and still keep it in a few years' time when I want to enter into, longer term, you know, property for themselves. But often people can't do that, whether it's the income or borrowing capacity or savings. And so it's really dangerous just taking this rent vesta view, which is prolific out there. It makes a lot of sense, right? Target people who, and there's a massive increase in what I'd say data-driven buyer's agents that are perpetuating this whole view that rent vesting is really easy, and that, you know, you should just buy as many properties as you want. And they've got big followings, and they're writing, and they're pushing people down multiple properties on hypothetical growth returns. And they're not really thinking about talking it through with a client, right? And saying, how does this fit into your longer term plan? How are you then going to go and buy a house? How many of these, there's just literally buy, buy, buy. Like, you've got money, buy. Best time to buy property was yesterday, if not today. That mentality is there. I'm buying here. It's a great opportunity. You should buy here. But that's not how people's lives work. You know, they've got other goals and things to achieve, and everyone's got different situations. So I do think there's a real drive of those. There's some massive companies writing huge volumes of properties. And I do think they're not letting their customers aren't making those bigger, longer term decisions. They're just solving their cash in their bank account. And they're not dealing with the pain of what will come down the line, particularly when they get to the family time. You know, I didn't always have kids, right? I didn't understand what it'd be like once you have kids, but absolutely life changes, right? Your priorities change. what you care about change, and you go from potentially being a gypsy and be happy to move around. If you get kicked out of rental, it's fine. Just an opportunity to live somewhere else. But when you've got kids and things like that, that is not something that you want for your kids and stability and the stress of it all. So that's what we see, is people don't think through their longer term plan enough.
No, I agree with you. And, you know, I tend to pose them some longer term questions, because I think it's the entry and exit costs, which is just worth highlighting again, right? Stamp duty, transaction costs. I mean, you won't actually recover those costs unless you're holding the property for quite some time, or you have massive capital appreciation. Now, if you're buying a second class or a, you know, dog of a property, the chances of capital appreciation is quite low, probably. And so you end up with this noose around your neck. And what you've done is actually you've given away the opportunity to buy something better later. And I've had a few people who've said to me they've actually regretted now buying in the last couple of years. But it's hard to get out. You know, once you're in, because it's, you know, it's not easy to get back out again. So this is a real problem, right? So the entry and exit costs and the opportunity avoided or opportunity missed costs if you do the wrong thing are huge.
You've got a really good point there, Martin, where you said it's actually getting out of the property. It's not, people don't think about that. So they think about it's easy to buy, but they don't think about how easy it's going to be to sell. And what is the process to sell an investment property? How do you do it, you know, and how fast can you do it? Property isn't shares. It's not liquid asset like that. You can just flip it very quickly. So people don't think about that enough. I think you're right. Doing the numbers, right? So let's say you buy a property at 500. You pick the next growth hotspot that outperforms the city, and it does really well over 3 years. It goes 40% up, right? So it goes from 500 to 700. But you paid 25K in stamp, you paid, you know, 15K to sell it. You maybe had some sunk costs, let's say another 10 or 20K. So maybe you made 100K. Then you got to pay capital gains tax, which is say circa 20-25%. So maybe you walked away with, I don't know, 100, right? And that's it going really well. If it went 30%, maybe you make 50K. Like, does that 50K really change your home ownership dreams? Maybe not. Like, so that's maybe not going to. And so, are you potentially, you know, and that's if it goes really well. What happens if it doesn't go up 30%, it goes up 20%? Well, you've not made anything. You've actually now got an investment property that, you know, if you sell, you don't really walk away with much at all. And so what happens is we see is that, you know, they get down a few years line and then they go, okay, I do want to buy, but then you've got to sell, you've got to get a tenant out, you've got to style it, you've got to fix it up, you've got to time it with sales times of the year. It's not that simple. And then you've got to try to sell that, and then you've got to get into the market, and you don't want to buy till you've sold. And whereas if you just got the money in the bank, you can transact really fast because there's no other transaction that's linked to. And especially poor properties. So easy to buy, hard to sell. Best properties are hard to buy. You're going to miss out. You're going to have to, you know, find something pre-market. You're going to have to potentially go to auction. You're potentially going to have to say no to 10 properties and then go really hard on one property. It's, you know, great properties are hard to buy, but once you own them, they're easy to sell in any market. Whether it's the market's booming or the market's in a downturn, people go, actually, I really always want to be in that street or in that aspect, in that location. No one else is selling in that pocket. I'm the only property. I've got no competition. So always try to remember that if you're buying properties, it's hard to buy, easy to sell. The hard work's up front. The rewards come from doing that hard work.
But buying the right property, right? That's the whole point. Not all properties are listed equally, right? Not all properties are actually available equally. And as we said earlier on, the trouble is at the moment, a lot of the stuff that is being listed are more like dogs rather than stars.
Yeah, absolutely. And that will continue because people, you know, particularly if you're in a good home right now and you are stuck or you have to upgrade, like you go, okay, I'd love to be on that street versus this street, but it's not a deal breaker. It's not going to change my life that much. I'd love to maybe have that better aspect, or I'd love to be a little bit closer to the water, but, you know, that's going to cost me a bomb to do that. This house is pretty good. We're pretty happy here. And so it makes sense, right? So people are in the home, unless it's a real big lifestyle challenge to live in it, yep, they're going to stay and they're going to renovate. And so that's what you get. So quality assets are actually getting harder to buy each year, A, because people are staying, and B, because people are living longer. You know, people were dying in the 80s. Now, you know, the surviving partner might live well into the 90s, right? They don't want to go into aged care. The kids want to keep them in the property because it's their inheritance. People are staying. And then so all elements, the first-time buyers, the upgrader, the investors are likely to keep those properties as well. Like if they've got a good house and it's done really well and they've kept it over decades, unless they have to sell it, they probably won't. They'll use their super. They'll use their share portfolio in retirement. They won't sell their investment property because the growth on it and the rental increase has probably made that got a super amount of equity in it. It's paying itself. They don't need the income because they've got other assets. And if they sell it, they pay a big capital gains tax bill. And they know it's a good asset. So what they do is they end up delaying the sale of their quality investment property as long as possible. It's one of the last assets they sell. Because, you know, when you get to retirement, it's not a... If you do that, you pay CGT. And it's washing its face anyway. It's not paid off. So I've got a good rental income from it as well. So that's another thing that is leading to scarcity is the investors just sitting on those properties because there's huge capital gains tax bills if they sell.
Yeah, the capital gains stuff is a real shock for many people. They never thought it through until they have to confront it, right? And it's a big, big issue.
And they don't want to pay it, right? Mm. So people naturally don't like loss avoidance, loss aversion, I mean. Paying that just doesn't feel right, to pay $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 of capital gains tax. I'll do everything I can just to avoid doing that. I'd rather use my shares or my super where I don't have to pay this tax. And so, absolutely.
Now, another stylized conversation, it relates to failed builders. So I've got quite a few people that I've spoken with who've actually committed to buying a home and land package. And, you know, they've started the process and then the builder goes belly up and they're in this horrendous situation where they've already got some commitments they can't get out of. They've got no means to be able to actually get the property finished because they can't find an alternative builder without much higher prices. And that is, for me, one of the really sorry stories that I'm unfortunately hearing quite often these days. So if people are thinking about buying and particularly, you know, looking at a builder to build for them, what is the critical question that they should be asking, Chris?
Oh, it's a hard one, Martin, right? Like we've got clients on every element of the build, like some issues. We've seen people who are doing the top end. Builders have walked out on them mid-job, just not going to be profitable. We've seen people doing multi-million dollar builds where I think about one in Brisbane, the builder went bankrupt twice. He actually, luckily we didn't, the payment release from the bank, he was pushing for it, the builder, but he was also going insolvent at the same time and he wanted the money in his bank account. So I think so he was going to pocket it himself, right? So we've had issues like that. We've had issues where, mid-build, the builder's on a fixed price contract and they said, we can't finish it unless we get more money. So they had the buyer or the builder under the barrel. We've had people who bought house and land packages and they can't get finance because their borrowing capacity is not there and they've got contracts. So they had to walk away from builds and lose deposits. We've seen a big multi-million dollar apartment 3 weeks out from getting finished, the builder went under. Big builder, like a big name. So I don't know. It's rife, these problems, right? And these aren't just in the small builders. Yeah, absolutely. There's more risk going with someone who's been doing it 5 years and hasn't got all those buffers built up and hasn't gone through cycles and blah, 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 right? But the big issues are big builders, and big builders can always, you know, close down certain projects if they're not working, right? So, I don't know if there's a silver bullet. Personally, some of those, they negotiated too hard, I feel. Like some of them, he admitted himself, he probably negotiated a bit too hard. That was the one that walked off the job. Ended up getting finished, but it was a nightmare appointing another builder. The issue in that situation is the banks are very, very nervous. And so because you've got a half-finished property and you're running out of cash, they can't really sell the property. So if you default, it's a nightmare for the bank. And so they find it really hard to lend you more money. And so if you are doing a build, I'd really encourage you to go with a construction loan. And so the banks are aware, the bank does all the valuations. You get a fixed price contract. You try not make any alterations. You go with experienced builder. You want that's but even I think of another builder clients, a big name, you know, builder where this thing's just dragged on from weather, material. The builder made lots of issues. Yeah, they've got a fixed price contract, but the clients had to rent another place. They've had multiple different changes with the fixtures and fittings and arguments over things. It's been a nightmare. They're getting the job done, but the builder is, you know, getting dragged and it's not happening. They're not prioritizing it versus other jobs because it's, you know, loss making for them. So yeah, you know, I've been to a, you know, some mates who are architects, some they're getting builders, you know, calling them to look for work. And they haven't really seen that in the last few years. So I think there is going to be a bit of more competition. That's what his belief is, that, you know, the margins, they'll try to, you know, maybe the material prices there, maybe labor prices won't drop as, you know, much as we expect. But maybe they just take a little bit out of their margin to buy work over the next couple of years until more confidence is there. So, and maybe instead of being a 15% margin, maybe they go for a 13 or 12 or something like that, instead of not having work next year.
Well, the point you make, Chris, I think is that, you know, no builder is necessarily completely 100% safe, right? From big to small, from somebody who's been around for years versus those who've actually started relatively recently, you know. So caution, caution, caution. If somebody's going to put, you know, their life savings into a property and hope that it's going to actually get built, there's some really, really hard questions to ask. And actually, I personally think it's really quite high risk at the moment because, you know, if you look at the latest numbers from ASIC, failures amongst the building and construction sector are the biggest. It's the biggest proportion of total company failures in the building and construction, and it's countrywide, and it's not just large or small. It's a range, so it's real tough.
Yeah, absolutely right. And if you are, you know, you don't want to do that when you're super confident, right? We've all seen the Porter Davis. It's been all over the 60 Minutes and the news channels, right? All how these builders. So it's widespread. So it's common knowledge that it's a bit risky right now. And are people willing to do that under high rates? And that's why I think approvals. And so A builders are finding it really hard to make the deal stack up, right? Profitable for them. And can they actually get finance? But B, do they want to do it? Do they want to take that risk in this market? And I'd say that they're a bit hesitant. So
Edwin Almeida has just come in and said, give me a builder that will give you a fixed price contract and I'll give you Elvis' latest address.
it's a good point, Edwin. I think we are seeing that though. Like I have seen some, you know, talking to a few people, we've seen a few more positive results there. But you're right, in Brisbane in particular, right? We have multiple clients who just couldn't do it. So they couldn't build because they couldn't get a fixed price contract. No bank would do a cost plus. Unless you had a lot of equity.
Absolutely. Well, we're coming to the end of the show. I think we've answered pretty much all the questions that got thrown in the chat, so that's good. So as we close out, you've got the view, I think, that it is likely that property prices will maintain and go higher rather than go lower, just to recap that, just for people's and the answer is supply demand, a lot of people still cashed up, low levels of real good property around, but net net property has still got a run.
Yep. And you know, like, we're just going to read what we see, right? So I was seeing the change in buyer behavior, like that's what we get access to, like as a mortgage broker, we don't see all parts of the market, but what we definitely do is see, it's 9 o'clock, is what current property owners are thinking, right? And what new buyers are thinking, right? And we saw all the way back in October, I would have said it on this podcast, we saw buyer mentality shifting. We saw that coming into January and February. We saw our pre-approval list. We saw the appetite and the attitudes toward debt and the challenges first-time buyers were having. And so that May, June, those couple of rate increases, that was a bit of a scary moment, right? But I think if rates do, and even if there was one more rate increase, I don't think that would scare buyers. If there was three or four more rate increases and it went closer to 5%, absolutely, this is a different ballgame. You could, if you're looking to buy, you could make that bet. But what happens if you're wrong? What happens if that doesn't happen? And you come back in 12 months' time and go, I got it wrong. Well, you could easily be seeing the opposite happening, rate cuts and prices run on you. And that's what I think's happened, right? I think a lot of people who are playing this game about trying to time property markets have got it wrong multiple years. It surprises everyone. All markets do all the time. And so you just got to be careful. Are you, if your wishful thinking's stopping you making property decisions, right? The analysis paralysis, the confirmation bias, the filter that you've got yourself in, the what you surround your mind with, and whether you just get stuck in that paralyzed state, hoping that this dream world happens where your dream property comes on at the dream price and the property market falls to that price where you're going to buy. You probably wouldn't want to buy at that point anyway, because you'd be so scared. You'd be like, oh, property prices are falling 40%. They're going to fall another 40%. That's just human psychology, because you'd think you're right. And then you'd read some more information that says that. So that would be my thoughts is, if you are, and then be super careful. Like, that, if you go all the way back 5 years ago, Martin, what I've said hasn't changed, like in terms of the asset quality and why it's so important. And you know, that if people were listening to that advice 5 years ago, they wouldn't have gone since high density. You know, they wouldn't have bought an apartment in Parramatta, or, you know, and be down, and they wouldn't have bought, you know, a lot of new townhouses and greenfield estates, which have gone up a bit, to be fair, due to just that lack of land and that increase in demand. And they've been quite resilient, to be honest, through all these. But they haven't grown as much as more scarce land near the city, right? And so, yeah, that would be my take, Martin. Probably not what some of your property bears want to think here, but that would be my if things flip, don't be surprised if the market runs hard till affordability gets stretched beyond what you think's possible. Because affordability is already stretched up beyond what's possible now if you look at percentages. But if all those ingredients happen, rate cuts, APRA, and confidence runs on a small number of listings, you could see prices run quite fast.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate your time, Chris. And part of the reason for having a range of voices on this channel is to give people the perspectives, you know, not just one perspective, right? And that's why it's always great to have you on. If people want to find out more about what you do and where you go, what's the best place to direct them to?
We've got a couple of podcasts. Got the Australian Property Podcast. It's been going about 4 or 5 months, so you can definitely take a listen to that. We've got 20,000 listens to that. We've got the Elephant in the Room podcast, been going 5-6 years, and Blusk, BLUSK.AU. If you jump on there, fill in a little form, the team will get back to you, and we'll have a chat and see how we can help.
Terrific, Chris. Well, thank you very much for your time this evening. Really appreciate it. And we'll tic-tac down the road as as things continue. Yep. What we always conclude is, it's complicated, right? There's a lot of different things going on, but it's always worth exploring them. So thank you very much indeed for your time. Appreciate it. I'm going to take you off air now, and I'm going to close the show. Thanks, Chris.
Yeah, Martin. Thanks a lot.
Cheers. So there you go, folks. Interesting conversation with Chris. Always a great value. And next week, we're going to have a discussion about the economic backdrop with Damien Klassen. So join me for that. And just to show you the doggies who are now back in their baskets again. So they've been following closely what's been going on. But they look ready for their walk, so I better go and take them out. So thank you for spending some time with us this evening. Really appreciated it. Have a great evening, and I'll look forward to catching up with you next week. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, signing off. Cheerio.